Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings Podcast. Welcome to November, everyone, and I know that I say this most weeks, but this week, I really have someone seriously fun to introduce you to. John Brink and I got along like a house on fire, and once we got started talking, I really didn't want the conversation to stop. He was born in 1940 in Nazi-occupied Holland during the Second World War, and his story of his miracle ties into this childhood and ties in to what life looked like during that time. When he told me the story, my jaw just dropped. It is absolutely gorgeous and really does go to show that magic and miracles are always around us and always leading us to where we are exactly meant to be. Now, John is many things, as most of my guests are, and he's really involved in some things that are very, very fun. He's a bodybuilder. He talks a lot about his ADHD and dyslexia. He's a very, very successful entrepreneur and has his own podcast, and he's a writer, is a storyteller, is a speaker. Pretty much this man does it all. But his story this week, John has a way with words that is absolutely captivating. So now, without further ado, here's the very next episode of the Bite-Sized Blessings Podcast.
Then for about a month, behind our house, about 30 feet away, maybe, was a schoolyard and about 25 Canadian soldiers from the Canadian Army Red Cross were there supporting the Canadian Army. But we would do every morning, we would go down there as little kids because we had not had food, and they gave us bread with cheese and butter, and the cheese and the butter was bigger than the bread.
Who are you as a human being? If you had to go to a conference or a party and you had to introduce yourself, how would you do that?
I'm spontaneous. I'm outgoing. I'm a happy-go-lucky, always positive. That's me.
I know, and it's really remarkable. And I was just saying that I kind of know a little bit about your early life, and I do have to say that you have an incredible life story. And I mean, I know from my childhood that I had some challenges. There were some things that were really, I don't know, depressing, difficult, heartbreaking. And for me, I look on those experiences, they've made me more resilient. They've made me more able to understand the beauty and the joy in the world. And I would say your childhood also, did it shape you in that way as well?
Yeah, very much so. Still part of who I am.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't even imagine, on your bio, you said that you grew up kind of around World War II, post-World War II. And what was it like being a child during that time?
Well, I was born, you probably asked me that during the podcast, but I was born November the 1st, 1940. So I'm going to be 84 in another week from now. And 84 years young, I call it. And, it was very, very difficult, and saw far too much that we should not have seen. Families were difficult. They, contrary to what some people think, there is war. After the war is over, everything goes back to normal. No, no, and no. It may stay difficult for the next couple of generations, maybe longer. So it's very, very much part of life. But it was an experience that I certainly will never forget. In fact, I do several presentations, and on the Remembrance Day, November the 11th, I'm making presentations to different schools as to why the 2 minutes of silence. And I believe that is very, very important. And so I do that, have done it for the last 12, 14 years. Go to a couple of schools in British Columbia, Canada, and to just share with the young people what it is like. In our case, this, I think this next, not this Friday, but the next Friday. Yeah. Very important.
I want to just say happy pre-birthday, if it's coming up. Happy pre-birthday. Now, I know you grew up overseas in Europe. I'm in the States right now. You live in Canada now. How did it happen that you came to emigrate west?
Well, that's a very good question, Kirsten, because it directly relates to the war years. We were liberated by the Canadian Army April the 12th, 1945. And it made such an impression on me that the Canadian soldiers, as part of the Allied forces, liberated us. And as I said, it made such an impression on me that I always knew from that point forward, I was going to go to the land of my heroes, Canada. And I was going to go when I was 17. My parents wouldn't let me. I was then drafted into the U.S. Air Force. And then I won when I was 23. And that is now 60 years ago.
Yeah. And I do have to say, I have a special place in my heart for Canada because so much of it is so ridiculously beautiful. Okay. And yeah, and they have a little bit of everything. You know, they have the ocean, of course, on both coasts, but lakes, mountains, woods, and it every kind of human being you could imagine in Canada. So I have a really, really deep affinity for Canada. So when you came over at that age, was it shocking for you or was it exciting? Was it an adventure? How did that happen for you?
So it was almost my dream to come to Canada, as I said earlier. The second one was that I was not a success story academically. I failed grade 3 and I failed grade 7 3 times. And they said, what are we going to do with this guy? And some people said, send him to the mentally challenged school. And they said, no, we'll teach him a trade. And my grandfather was a master carpenter. My dad worked in lumber. So they sent me at 13 to a furniture store, a furniture factory, actually. And at nights, I would go to the college to become a furniture maker. So that's what I did. And then, but I was a happy guy, always positive, but deep down, I kind of felt I had failed. And you know how young kids are. You know, all the kids that went to school with me in grade 7, I went on to college and university, and I became a laborer. I'm proud of that today, but then I wasn't. And so I wanted to prove to me that I was just as smart, not better than, but just as smart as the other ones. And so I wanted to start with nothing. And so I took, when I left in July of 1965, I left with 1 suitcase, 3 books, 2 sets of clothes, very little money. And I was going to go to British Columbia because I was the other dream that I had, build a lumber mill. And so that's where all the trees are. So I took the plane to Montreal, took the train from Montreal to Vancouver, 4 days, 5 nights. My God, that is slow and long. And so I went to the immigration office in Vancouver. Fortunately, there was, could speak English, didn't know a soul, didn't have a job. So there was a German fellow that I could speak some German. And I told him I wanted to build a lumber mill. He said, Prince George, John, go to Prince George. So Prince George is 500 miles north of Vancouver, or for our European friends, 800 kilometers. That's in the center of British Columbia, north, south, east, west. And so I took the bus, Greyhound, 14 hours to Prince George, and I came off the bus in Prince George, and with the dream I was going to build a lumber mill. And I had my suitcase, my three books, two sets of clothes, and I counted my money at least three times. I had $25.47. That same evening, I found a job through the immigration department because there was somebody that spoke Dutch. And so they found me a job as a cleanup man. But what I had when I came off the bus, other than what I said, I had a positive attitude. No matter how tough things are, I know tomorrow's going to be better. Passion. Whatever I do, I give it 125%. Work ethic. I work harder than anybody. And I still do that today. And every morning I get up at 5:30. I always make my bed and I always think I'm late. And then no matter what happens that day, it's going to be a great day for me. And so that doesn't mean I go through challenges once in a while, but that's fine. And we'll all turn around there to something positive. And that's what I've been doing for the last 60 years here. After I was here for a couple of years already, I became a superintendent of a large mill here, lumber mill. And then within 10 years, I built my lumber mill. And now I have several lumber mills and 10 other companies. So, but it's not about that. But that's, I always stay the course, never give up. And so that's kind of what happened.
That's amazing. And I think it kind of really says to everybody that you have an adventurous spirit, that you follow your heart, and that you don't give up. And I'm so curious, I bet your family, they were probably pretty sad when you left.
Yes, but, you know, especially my mother and, you know, so they, but I didn't tell anybody that I was going to leave, but I had this thing that I had to deal with. And so I told them, I went to the Canadian embassy in Holland and got a permit to emigrate and become a landed immigrant. And I wanted to leave within 3 weeks. And so I told everybody, and then I was gone. And so I knew I would not go back unless I was successful or in the box. And so a little bit radical, but so that's kind of how I felt about it. I was going to succeed.
That's really incredible. Did anybody else in your family follow you to Canada?
No.
Wow.
They visited me, but no, I'm the only one here.
That's astonishing. I mean, kudos to you for having such a strong vision and the commitment to follow it through, because I think a lot of people, they have these ideas, they have these visions of where their life can go and what, but they stop maybe halfway through or a quarter of the way through and they don't complete it or finish it. And it is truly the rare individual that says they're going to do something and then they actually follow through and do it. So wow, I love this story. Incredible. You're incredible. I'm so curious. My second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And what did that look like as a child or for your family later on?
Yeah, my mother was Christian, you know, and active. But for me, I'm agnostic. And so was the rest of my family. But Holland, as you likely know, is very liberal, but also very religious. In particular, Protestant, Northern Holland, primarily, Southern Holland, mainly Catholic. But very, very liberal, actually. So that does not mean to say that I do not respect and I have a set of principles that are very, very important to me, but I do not actively participate in any particular religion.
Thank you for that. And I wanted to go back to the comment that you made earlier about post-war, that everybody thinks, oh, it's just going to go back to normal kind of immediately. But no, I mean, looking at some of the photographs and just seeing the devastation and the damage, it kind of blows my mind after any war that people are able to rebuild and take the shattered remnants of buildings and, you know, the destruction of bridges and make it new again. Were you a part of that as you were growing up?
Yeah, so I was born in 1940, and to kind of give you a vision of my family, my mom and dad got married in 1938, 2 years before the war started, and they were in love, and they had paradise. They had a house they were renting, he had a job, and so they were a very, very happy couple and deeply in love. And so very quickly they had a son and then a daughter, and then I came behind. And so then what happened is Adolf Hitler decided that he was going to take over Europe. So invaded the Benelux companies, Holland in particular, in the early part of 1940. And my dad was drafted into the Dutch army in April of 1940. And then the last time they heard from him is when he was seen in Rotterdam just before they bombed it and thousands of people died. It would take 5 years for my mom, that was then pregnant with me, to find out if he lived or died. And so she was on her own with the two little kids and pregnant with me. And I was born in 1940. The first thing that I remember is that bombers overhead when I was 3.5, 4 years old, hundreds of bombers, 300, 400 bombers overhead bombing the German infrastructure, in particular in the northeastern part of Germany. We were living in the northwest of Holland, close to the northeast of Holland, I should say, close to the German border, within 10, 15 minutes. And at nights, we would go out and be on the flat roof behind the house, not to look or that we thought it was so pretty. Simply, she felt safer outside than inside. And in the distance, we should see the cities burning. The skies were red. And so that's the first thing. I still can hear the sound of hundreds of bombers. The other part that I remember, 1944 was in particular very, very difficult. In the winter 1944-45 was the coldest on record. At the same time, food was cut off by the German army to the Holland. And again, thousands and thousands of kids and older people that were vulnerable died because of lack of food. And what I still remember when I was 3.5, 4 years, to between 4 and 5 in particular, every morning, my sister, my brother, and myself, we would go out with gunny sacks in the railroad yards, pick up anything edible and burnable. And we did that every morning. And the reason that we did it, because they wouldn't shoot us, they would boot us one, but we'd be back the following morning. And then I remember the cold. It was so immensely cold. And we had this little stove in one little part of the house where we were sitting close to the stove to try to stay warm. So the cold and the heat, I still remember that part, is that being sit closer and closer to the stove, and then it was so immensely cold outside. And then the part that I remember is that when the Canadians were getting closer to the Germans, that they pushed back to Germany, things got pretty rough in that part of northeastern Holland. Saw far too many dead bodies and neighbors that were dragged out of their houses that never came back, and then saw people that were shot. Far too many like that always will stay with you, even at a time that you're nearly 4.5, 5 years old, you will never forget it.
So sorry, I can't even imagine. And with those memories and just the kind of understanding as you've gotten older and grown up, quote unquote, and maybe read more, I'm sure we've all read a lot about what happened in World War II and the lead up to it and whatnot. I'm sure you're looking at the US and you're thinking, oh my goodness, what is happening down there? And I think that having these conversations is so important because, especially with people who have gone through events like this and are brave enough and strong enough to tell the stories of what they experienced, other people need to hear those stories so that we can understand and appreciate what war really looks like and what it does to children, what it does to our neighbors, what it does to the people around us.
And then dictatorships that, democratic rule can be messy. It's is sometimes an interesting, but still is democratic rule. And at the end of the day, you will see that November the 5th, obviously, in the United States. United States is somewhat unique. I'm not talking about politics now, but they are looked at as the leaders of the free world. And here on November the 5th, they have the choice to elect a democratic rule or likely to be a dictatorship. And, and at the end of the day, the U.S. Constitution starts with we the people, and hopefully that we the people will think careful about what is and what can be and is so critically important.
I agree. Thank you for that. I think that, that's a whole other subject. I want to just say, I just want to ask you, these experiences that you had in your childhood, you just seem like such a formidable, impervious to setbacks kind of go-getter human being. How much did your childhood shape you into this person that wasn't going to take no for an answer with any of your dreams?
I was still affected by PTSD, still are today. And the other part that shaped me is the inner child. Never knew that there was such a thing as the inner child. But the fear of losing the only parent, had an immense effect on me. And I was well into my 50s when I got counseling for that, and very emotional, actually. So, appreciating, that how lucky and how fortunate we are is with me every day. And I fly around a lot, and I do a lot of businesses in the United States as well. And if I fly through the States and Canada, a lot of times I sit in commercial planes, I sit by the windows and I say, it's paradise. How lucky we are. And then I look towards Europe, the Ukraine, and some of the other places in Europe, Hungary, that is on the verge of dictatorships, and other things that are happening, Middle East, obviously, China, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, go on and on and on and on. Democratic rule is so critically, critically important. And, obviously, the United States is very interesting because it leads the world in free and democratic rule. And then Canada, by comparison, is very boring politically. but I always appreciate, North America, in particular Canada and the United States. And in Canada, it's a mosaic of people from all over the world, even more so in the United States, people from all over the world that formed these amazing countries in North America.
Thank you for that. Thank you. I am ever so curious, when you stepped off that Greyhound bus into Prince George, did you think to yourself, I am so excited to get started? Or did you think, what am I doing? Did you think, where am I? What was your thought process?
I know here I am. I was not going to go back no matter what. And I was going to build a lumber mill. So for me, it just became a question, not if, but how long would it take me to get there? So, and it also meant that I would, by choice, start from the bottom up as a cleanup man, lumber pilot, and then gradually make my way up. But I had a vision. There was nothing that was going to stop me. Nothing.
And, you know, as with all human beings, you are complex in that there are many different pieces to who you are. And, you know, I love that you also, you ride dressage, which I could never do because I just don't have that capacity. But you're also into bodybuilding and philanthropy, writing, public speaking. I mean, you are just this really gorgeously complicated and fun human being. But the dressage really got to me because I do love horses and I love saying hi and, like, you know, petting them and saying, will you be my friend? But dressage is like a whole other level of being one with the horse. And so how did that happen?
Actually, already I was lucky. My wife already was into dressage even before I met her. We've been together 41 years or so, 42 years maybe. And so she always loved horses. I did too, but I didn't ride in Holland. Two of my sisters were very much into riding the dressage. And my older sister, unless unfortunately she passed away at a young age, but, you know, she was competing in the European level of riding dressage and had a couple of horses. Amazing. So I always liked it. A lot of northeastern Holland is into farming and subsequently horses. So horses were always part of my family. And then here in British Columbia, I married my wife 40 years ago. So we got slowly into riding, but it took me till I was about 70 or so before I started riding dressage. But I always loved horses. They didn't intimidate me, and I like it.
I have to say that I'm just, what I really love is, or what I really hope for myself is that I never become bored with life, that I don't take it for granted, that I don't think, oh gosh, there's nothing more to learn in this world, that I always remain captivated by, like, the potential out there. And where did you get that kind of personality trait? You just are kind of unstoppable.
Yeah, I am. And I love life. I love the things that I do and even the challenges that go with it. Obviously, there are always some, but I always stay positive. And as I said, every morning I wake up at 5:30 in the morning I'm always excited about what is going to happen that particular day. And then at the same time, you know, I started to also at a later age is that one thing that happened to me as well, I should mention, and it was, I was already here for 32 years. This was in 1997. And a lot of people said to me, oh, John, you're so successful and blah, 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 and you should write a book and all of that kind of stuff. And I didn't do that. But then one day I went to a store here and I picked up a book, and the book changed my life. The title of the book was Driven to Destruction, written by Dr. Halliwell, medical doctor. And I opened the book while I was standing in the store, and I started looking at it. It was about ADHD. And I said, oh, my God, that's me. And so I wrote in the book. I still have it, actually, and I have it in my studio where I do podcasts in the actual book. That's why I was looking for that book. But I still have the actual book written by Dr. Halliwell. Dr. Halliwell has written 18 books, 5 on distraction, ADHD, and dyslexia. Same for me. I have ADHD and dyslexia. And so that changed my life. I wrote it in the book in Dutch because I was ashamed of it, because it was implied then that it was a mental disorder. And the more I got to know about it, I came to the conclusion it is a superpower. I found that so many people had the benefit of it, I say affected by, had the benefit of ADHD, but still was struggling with it, that I had to speak about it more, write about it more, understand more of it. We all go through the difficult times sometimes that we need this challenge that kind of says, hey, wake up, you know, because you're not doing something right. And so I nearly died in 2008. I had a case of diverticulitis. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's for our guests watching. On the right side is your appendix, and then on the left side, your colon. And so there was a rupture of my colon. And then very quickly, you have to attend it. Otherwise, it may kill you. And so I waited too long. And so I came this close. And then I knew my wife has always was a vegetarian, but I didn't listen quite as well as I could have, should have. And I do now. And so and I'm now vegan. And then the other part is I want to go to the gym. Before that, I was like everybody else. At the end of the year, we say we're going to do this, that. And I'm going to buy a membership to the gym. And then 2 weeks later, we have 100 reasons as why you'd be too busy to go to the gym. So 15 years ago, in 2009, after I recovered from the operation of taking out 20 centimeters of my colon, I knew I had to do my diet, be more careful about diet, and start going to the gym. I did that. And after I did that for about 6-7 years, by then it was 2016, 2017, and I was already 76 years old. And so somebody said, hey, John, have you ever thought about going to the compete? I said, me? Really? Yeah. I said, okay, I'm going to do that. So I did. And so I competed bodybuilding and physique. And I came in second bodybuilding, third in physique in Northern British Columbia. Then came in second bodybuilding, third in physique provincially. That qualified me for the Nationals and the Arnolds. And so then COVID came. And so now I'm training again at 85. At 2025, I want to go to the Arnolds again. And so I will start competing and showing again in April and then work my way towards the end. So I wrote a book about that. Living Young, Dying Old, that's me. And so, and that was important to me.
Oh my goodness. I just love all of this, I have to tell you. And I was thinking back to your story earlier on where you said, you know, you were in school, you failed third grade, you had to do seventh grade 3 times. And, you know, back then, nobody kind of knew about dyslexia, ADHD. They didn't really talk about it. Or if they did know about it, I don't know, people were busy, whatever. I think it's better now for kids that are dyslexic, like they get diagnosed earlier, but as a child, like kind of understanding and taking that idea on that you're not quote unquote smart or that you can't keep up with your kids in your class, that can be absolutely devastating. And what I really appreciate about your story and then all of your stories is that once again, you know, even as a kid, you're like, nope, I'm not going to let other people define me. I am going to go out and do what I say I'm going to do, and I'm going to define myself. And that takes a truly superior, like, intellect and personality to just not take on what society is telling you that you are or you should be. You've defined your own life, and I think that's really profound. So thank you for sharing all of that and the bodybuilding. And I'm so glad that you're here today with us to tell us all these stories. They're so, so fun. But I have to get to like the meat part of the podcast, which is I ask every single guest, I would love for you to tell a story, or you can tell more than one story of something in your life that you considered to be magical or miraculous.
Let me tell you this one, Kristen, and that probably fits in that category, in my opinion. So I already told you and your listeners that we were liberated by the Canadian Army, April the 12th, 1945. Then for about a month, behind our house, about 30 feet away, maybe, was a schoolyard, and about 25 Canadian soldiers from the Canadian Army Red Cross were there supporting the Canadian Army. And but we would do every morning, we would go down there as little kids because we had not had food, and they gave us bread with cheese and butter, and the cheese and the butter was bigger than the bread. And we called everybody Johnny. We didn't speak the language, but we did. And so that made that immense impression. So that led me to then from that point forward, I would go to the land of my heroes, Canada. So those 25 people that were there for about a month, month and a half, made an immense impression. So then when I came to Canada and here to Prince George, virtually on the other side of the world, and I became a superintendent of a sawmill, I got to know the sales manager of that mill, and I was very nervous because I didn't quite speak the language. And he invited me to his house. I was single then, obviously, young and working hard, but becoming a management employee, being a superintendent. So he invited me to his house for dinner. And his name was Jerry Wilmot. And so I went to his house on a Friday. I was very, very nervous and formally with his wife and me sitting there for dinner. And we talked about Holland and we talked about him and his wife and his family. He had a lumber mill here in Prince George. And he was in the Canadian Army. And he was the captain in that unit of 25 people in Holland.
Oh my gosh.
And then today, where I'm sitting here, on my boardroom in our main office of our lumber mill that I started here 50 years ago in July of 1975 on this location by the railroad. There was another mill located here on this location. And the title of the mill was Norman M. Smith. And the owner of Norman M. Smith, Captain Jerry Wilmot.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. I can't even believe that.
Yeah, I know. And I'm a realist. These things are not supposed to happen, but they did.
I just kind of am speechless right now because that is astonishing. I mean, just imagining you as children and just having to go to the rail yard every day to try to find whatever you could to stay warm or whatever you could to eat anything. And then you have this, the Canadians come in and liberate. But not only that, they set up behind your house and you go to them every day. And all of a sudden you're having these incredible luxuries, like these giant pats of butter and these giant slices of cheese. And it's almost like a dream, you know, I'm sure as children, like not believable, something out of a dream. And then, you know, you're life goes on. The Canadians, you know, go back to Canada or wherever they go. You have this dream and desire to go to Canada because of this experience of the Canadians. And then you end up in this place where the captain of those 25 men is there. And just it's almost like poetry.
And he had pictures of our houses and all those things. I took them with me to Holland and showed them to my parents and my mom. And that were right behind our house.
I am sure your mother actually couldn't believe it, because I don't.
No, it is unbelievable. And then to meet him here, now today where we are, Norman M. Smith was a small mill that operated on exactly the same footprint where today our head office is in Northern British Columbia. But this was owned up to 1964 by Captain Jerry Wilmot.
John, you were blowing my mind. I mean, honestly, I'm listening to this story and there's just this beautiful synchronicity running through all of it. And this connection, it's like this connection, you form this connection with these Canadian soldiers. And then later in life, you find yourself at dinner, no less, with your supervisor. And you have this conversation. I'm sure your supervisor was equally just astounded.
Yeah, but we didn't make the connection then in terms of the mill yet, you know, because I didn't know, you know, so yeah, I hadn't even started then. This was 1965. It would not be until 10 years later that I started this operation, not realizing this was Norman M. Smith and it was owned by Captain Jerry Wilmot.
I mean, I'm sure his wife was sitting at the table thinking, what is happening here? And this is just miraculous. I'm kind of just, my jaw is dropped here. And I just think to myself, it's almost like everything was fated for you to leave and come to Canada and then have this, not reconciliation, but just reconnection with this part of your childhood, where you were essentially liberated and saved by Canadian forces at the time. I mean, my gosh, I mean, how did you even deal with thinking about all this?
It's not supposed to happen. I'm a realist, right? So these things don't happen, but they do.
Enjoyed this episode with John Brink, and I hope you enjoyed all the stories that John had to tell. There's no doubt in my mind that he is a consummate storyteller and that you should check out each and every single one of his books, including Living Young, Dying Old, How to Thrive in Your Mid-80s. I know we're not all there yet, but I bet there are some important lessons and things we can learn from that book that might help us even now. There will be a link to John's website so you can check out a little bit more about this incredible human being, about all of the things that he's involved in, all of the books that he's written. He really is a prolific writer. Thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear, please do consider writing a review or leaving a little rating wherever you listen to the podcast. Those ratings and reviews, they help other people find us. And I really do want to bring these stories of hope, of resilience, of magic to a larger part of the world. I want more people to remember that this world is a beautiful place. So with your ratings and reviews, I can do that. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like John. Do not take no for an answer. Oh yeah, and really do not allow others to define you. People are so quick to categorize these days, to judge others, to put other people in the little boxes that they think they belong. But be like John and say, no, I absolutely refuse to go in that box. I refuse to let you limit me. Know that in fact that all possibilities are on the table, that you are the master of your destiny, and how large you can dream, well, that's the limit of all you can achieve. So be like John, dream bigger than big, never take no for an answer. And so very soon, I suspect you'll be looking around and reveling at just where you suddenly find yourself.